order. Welcome, everyone. We are going to start today from the bottom up with a public hearing on HCR 11, Council.
Get the mic.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, HCR comes to you from Representative Bonamici. The bill memorializes Michael T. Muniz, Immigration Law Authority.
And we have Representative Bonamici here to testify. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Suzanne Bonamici. I represent House District 34, which is in Washington County, and I'm the chief sponsor of House Concurrent Resolution 11, which is a memoriam in the life of Michael Muniz. Mm-hmm. I want to acknowledge Michael's wife, Lydia Muniz, who is here today. She works in the governor's office as an advocate for minority women in emerging small businesses, and also Michael's close friend, Danny Santos, who is a policy advisor to the governor, who's also submitting written testimony today. Michael was not my constituent, but he was my friend and a colleague. I first met him in 1978 when he was a Reggie at Lane County Legal Aid. Some of you might remember the Reggie program, the Reginald Heber Smith Community Law Fellowship, which was named after the founder of Legal Aid. And Michael was one of the kind of people who really devoted his life and his career to helping those less fortunate. He earned his bachelor's degree in political science from the University of California, Santa Barbara, his law degree from Lewis and Clark Law School in 1978. And after we worked together at Legal Aid, Michael went on to other legal services programs, focusing his work on immigration, disability, farm worker rights, economic development, and senior issues. He went on to private practice. He had an office in Portland and in Salem for a while, published several articles, and became a highly respected speaker, particularly on immigration law. And following the lead of our mutual friend, former State Representative Rocky Berea, Michael went on to teach immigration law at both the University of Oregon Law School, my alma mater, and at Lewis and Clark Law School. In 2005, the Oregon chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association honored Michael, one of his many honors during his career, recognizing his outstanding and tireless advocacy of immigrant rights. On September 29th, the Portland Business Journal published an article, Immigration Law Boom. And Michael was quoted in the article, which talked about the Department of Homeland Security and overlap with Oregon law. Well, Michael was quoted in the article discussing how immigration law practice really varies with and is dependent on the actions of Congress. And that article was published one day before his untimely passing, which was on September 30th of 2006. Michael was really the kind of person who had this combination of intellect, charm, ethics, optimism, empathy, and really a dedication to helping those in the community. And as I've talked with many people at his memorial service and since I've been sponsoring this memorial, it's incredible how many people speak so highly of his public service, the dedication to public service, and also his high standards. I want to tell a story that Michael's brother Matthew shared at the memorial service. And I want to tell you about the memorial service, which was you get a room full of hundreds of friends and family members, many of whom were lawyers and some of whom were politicians, and an open mic. It was an interesting conversation, but the stories were just really touched the heart. And Michael's brother told a story about a young woman who came up to Michael and said, "You don't remember me, but my family was your client when I was a little girl. And you're the reason I'm an American now. I was so impressed with you that I decided I wanted to help other immigrant families. And because of you, I'm now in my third year of law school." So that's the kind of effect that Michael had on not just his clients, but people who knew him. His contributions to our state will be greatly missed. And I urge you to join me in honoring his life and career by sending House Concurrent Resolution 11 to the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this to us. I didn't know Michael, and I wish I had. Are there questions or comments from the committee? Thank you very much. Danny, you want to come on up and bring Mrs. Muniz if you want to?
Thank
Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Danny Santos. While I serve as a policy advisor for the governor, my role here today is more of a friend and colleague of Michael Muniz. With me is Ludy Muniz, the wife of Michael Muniz, and it's my privilege to have her as a colleague and friend. I submitted my written testimony. I won't take up more of your time other than to note one of the sections in the testimony, and that comes from the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Paul de Munis, and I'll just read the quote he raised. And speaking about Michael Muniz, he said, "He was a wonderful human being. He was a person who walked his talk. He believed in service to man. He believed in service to the community. And he believed in this legal aid service that he participated in for a good bit of time. I want all of us to acknowledge that he was a kind of lawyer that demonstrates what legal aid is about. For Michael, being a lawyer was not a job, it was a calling. For those of us here recognize that and need to honor that. So again, as the colleague and friend of Michael Muniz, I ask for your support of this resolution. Thank you very much."
Thank you very much. Are there questions, Mr. Santos? And welcome, Mrs. Muniz, to the committee. You didn't sign up, and you don't have to talk, but we wanted to welcome you. Thank you for being here. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the – is there anybody else who wants to speak on this? I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR 11 and open a work session on HCR 11. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 11 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved HCR 11 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, only that I really enjoyed listening about Mr. Muniz's life, and I'm disappointed I did not have the opportunity to know him, but you have made me feel as if I did, so thank you very much.
Thank you for bringing this to us. Okay, no objection, so ordered. Is there anyone on the committee who knew Mr. Muniz? Did you know him?
Did not, but okay. I'd be glad to be honored to carry it if you'd like for me to.
Well, that would be great. Thank you. Okay. Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2833. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2833 comes to you from Representative Barker. Allows a public safety officer at the time of he or she is hired to designate a beneficiary to receive benefits from the Public Safety Memorial Fund, allows a person designated as beneficiary to receive benefits from the fund, allows a family member or parent to receive benefits if no beneficiary is designated, expands the definition of child to include a person 18 to 22 years of age and enrolled at a full-time undergraduate student or 18 years of age or older and capable of self-support due to physical or mental disability, from the current 19 years or older, repeals ORS 243-969, which lists the succession of beneficiaries.
Okay. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barker, and I'm the state representative for House District 28, Beaverton and Aloha. Thank you for hearing this bill today. House Bill 2833 allows a public safety officer to designate a beneficiary to receive benefits from the Public Safety Memorial Fund. Under current law, spouse, child or dependent of an officer is eligible to receive benefits from the fund if the officer suffers a serious injury that finishes their career or dies in the line of duty. The bill also expands the definition of child for the purposes of receiving benefits to include a person 18 to 20 years old enrolled full-time as an undergraduate student or 18 years or older and unable to support themselves due to physical or mental disability. My office worked with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and the Oregon Council of Police Associations to ensure that House Bill 2833A was something that was easy as possible to implement. I'm happy to report the bill passed unanimously in the House Judiciary Committee and on the House floor. It's a good bill, and I appreciate your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. We had this bill last year, but it got caught up in the end of the session and didn't get moved. But it's a good bill. It was, for an example, somebody may have a sister or brother that needs more financial assistance, and if they pass, then an elderly parent or something. This just allows the officer to take care of that.
Okay, and that would be instead of the traditional beneficiary.
Right. It was, yeah, before, if you were not married, it had to go to the parents. And there was a lot of cases, or I don't know, I shouldn't say a lot of cases, there was cases where that would have been more appropriate to allow the officer to designate somebody else.
Okay. But if the person has a spouse, then it automatically
goes to the spouse. It goes to the spouse, correct, yes.
And or children.
Yeah. And it's, you know, this is set up to kind of keep the wolves away from the door. If some officer is killed, firefighter, for 12 months it'll pick up their mortgage payment. There's some lump sum, and then there's money for the children to attend college later.
Madam Chair, I have a question. What about domestic partner, whether it's same sex or opposite sex?
They could
who
designate.
Does it go to first?
It would go to that party. You could designate it to your domestic partner.
Okay. Because a lot of folks don't get married for whatever reason, and they just live together, no matter what sex they are. Okay.
Before we go to Mr. Lesher, could you just remind us of how this fund is funded?
For criminal fines and assessment, there's a little slice that keeps going into that. And I've talked with Mr. Menace over at DPSST about that, and he says at the time he thinks there's enough to cover it, but he'd like to have a little bigger. He wants to build that up. Because when the three firefighters died down in Coos Bay a couple of years ago, there was like 9 children involved in it. So those things kind of, you can get caught if there was some emergency where a lot of officers got killed, or a year where a lot of officers got killed, mm-hmm. public safety people. It could be that way, but it comes out of that fund and builds up it builds up a fund with shaving off a little bit of the fines and assessments.
Okay, maybe Senate Bill 400 will help in that regard. Okay, Mr. DeLashmet.
Brian DeLashmet, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Oregon State Police Officers Association. Just very briefly, there are several components historically to the Public Safety Memorial Fund. One is a cash payment to the family. What you're really talking about in this particular case is that cash payment could go to a designee rather than to the family directly. And when this was first set up by then Representative Westland as a result mm-hmm. of a state trooper in Klamath Falls, the Klodfelder getting shot on duty, the need was an almost immediate, within the 7-day need, of some cash to deal with funeral expenses and some transitional dollars. That's what we're really dealing with in this bill, is you can designate that to someone else that you would hope would take care of those immediate expenses and so forth. The other elements basically remain unchanged, which is the scholarship and the insurance pieces are the same. But what we're really attempting to do here is catch those circumstances in which there wasn't a spouse or they chose to have some designation to someone else. Very simple bill.
I remember when this bill was in the legislature in 1999. I was in the House with Representative Westland, then Representative Westland.
And Senator Burdick, we too hope that we never have to use this fund.
Okay, thank you. We agree on that. Any other questions, comments from the committee? Close public hearing on House Bill 2833 and open a work session on House Bill 2833. Senator Byer.
I'm chairing with House Bill 2833 to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2833 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this?
Excuse me, sure.
Okay. Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2765. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2765 comes to you from Representative Lim and Olson. Requires the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to require at least 24 hours of training in mental illness recognition using a crisis intervention training model.
Okay, we have Michael Morris and Mary Botkin signed up.
Chair Burdick and excuse me, members of the committee, my name is Mike Morris and I am the manager for our Quality Improvement and Certification Unit with the Addictions and Mental Health Division with the Department of Human Services. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2765A. Unfortunately, the tragic events recently have highlighted the gap in the training and knowledge of some law enforcement in regards to recognizing mental illness and knowing how to address and deal with those particular issues. This bill would, you know, provide necessary training for initial certification for police officers. This is mentioned that there is a crisis intervention training. There is a formalized process called crisis intervention team, and there's training that's associated with that, which is typically delivered at the local level involving the local agencies partnering with law enforcement to develop the training and deliver the training. This would use the concepts that are in that particular training for the initial certification of police officers, and we strongly support this training for law enforcement. Be willing to answer any questions.
I saw in the original bill that you had some specifics about the training. It would include 12 hours of classroom training and 12 hours of scenario training, and that was deleted in the A and Gross. Why was that taken out?
Chair Burdick, I think DPSST was working with the proponents of the bill to look at what's currently being offered. And I believe what they said is they could, in their scenario training, which they currently offer, which covers a wide variety of different scenarios, that with 20 hours of training that's in this bill, is that they would be able to make sure that more of the scenarios would involve scenarios that involve individuals with a mental illness or addictive disorders.
Okay, so basically it was a decision not to place sideboards on the nature of the training. Okay. Yeah, I see we have Senator Lim in the audience. Senator Lim, did you, excuse me, Representative Lim, did you want to add your comments to this bill?
Yes, ma'am.
2765.
Yes, thank you.
Madam Chair Burdick and members of the committee, for record, my name is John Lim, state representative from District 50, and I do appreciate the chair and members hearing that the House Bill 2765A, and I have a written testimony, and I will be very brief. I come before you today to testify on the bill, House Bill 2765, which requires State Academy to establish a minimum of 24 hours of crisis intervention training, which is CIT, in their curriculum for law enforcement cadets. This subject became dear to my heart as I followed the story of James Chessy last October. KAT News reported that Mr. Chessy died of trauma to his chest as police restrained him. It later came out that Mr. Chessy suffered from schizophrenia. I do not want to put blame on any law enforcement officers. I just want to prevent losing more lives, which is good for the mentally ill community and good for the public image. CIT model have been successful since 1988. They originated in the Memphis Police Department when Memphis look for a way to prepare their police with how to handle special responses where lives may not be in danger or may be in danger in immediate, but somebody is acting erratically. 1998, Memphis Police Department joined in a partnership with the Memphis chapter of the Alliance of Mental Illness, the Mental Health Providers, University of Memphis, and the University of Tennessee. Since implementing this training, Tennessee, Texas, and Ohio have been benefited from the CIT model. According to the Memphis Police Department website, the city of Memphis has experienced immediate crisis response and a decrease in the use of force and arrest, and officers' injury during the crisis event have declined. In Akron, Ohio, more than 3,000 individuals have been processed by CIT officers since May 2000, with about 75% of the case being transported for mental health treatment and 6% arrested. And then currently in our state, according to the survey 2002, 163,986 mentally ill people, which is about 5.4%. The numbers continue to grow. We have a population continually growing and vulnerable and could be misinterpreted. With the CIT training, 24 hours, and we could prevent some of the tragedy that happened before. And as you may know, already in the past, we passed unanimously of this House bill. 50A, yay, one absent, one excuse. This is unanimous. I hope consider passing this bill from your committee, and I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Lim. Any questions? Thank you. Senator Cruz.
I'm assuming that this is, we're talking 24 hours, this is not in addition to what's already in the curriculum. This is just, they will modify the curriculum. So we aren't looking at 32, we're still looking at 24, basically, correct?
Chair Burdick and Senator Cruz, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, currently, if I may, that the, I talked to the former senator, that is John Minnis, and they currently have up to 20 hours of a training program, and either that the academic or field training. And this will require just 24 hours, either field or the classroom training.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Representative Lim, if you need to leave, we will understand.
I do appreciate it. Thank you very much for
hearing.
Thank
you very much. Ms. Botkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And originally we had a bill in the House as well that required training for all public safety personnel, starting with 911 and working its way all the way through to parole and probation for mental health training. And intervention training for all public safety officers. This is the bill that they have chosen to move, and it has eliminated what we consider to be one very key piece of our original bill, which was the training of corrections officers through DPSST. And we believe the DPSST can do the same thing for corrections officers that they do for police officers who work the streets, and that is to redesign their curriculum to include 24 hours of intervention training. I just want to caution folks that it only takes one very dramatic death and wrongful death suit on behalf of the families inside the prison system to more than pay for this training if there are any additional funds, and I don't believe there are. Because what we're suggesting is the same thing that they suggested with police officers, and that is to redesign the curriculum to include mental health training in that curriculum that corrections officers receive now. And
are you saying you want yourself added into the bill?
Yes, and we've been working with Senator Gordley on a lot of the mental health training issues. And we talked to her this morning about amending corrections officers back into the bill.
Guess what? Our crack staff and Senator Byer just pointed out the relating clause. Nice try.
Thanks, Mr. Taylor.
Okay.
You know, I didn't look at the relating to clause.
God, you know, you just, you know, gotta
and,
do that.
And you know, Bill Taylor's been telling me for years about those darn relating to clauses. I apologize for wasting the committee's time.
I will invite you to take a look at other relating clauses and see if you might accomplish it in one of them.
I do think it's, with 30%, nearly 30% of our population being diagnosed as mentally ill, we've had several unfortunate incidences in the system. And I just think it's critical that these officers get the same sort of training that you're talking about giving street cops.
Well, and it's also a safety issue for all concerned.
Well, for the clients especially.
Yeah.
So,
okay,
anyway,
thank you. Thank you very much. And again, take a look at other relating.
I'll go find the new relating.
Can't believe. Now, how long have you been in this building?
10 minutes.
Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2765. and open a work session on House Bill 2765. Senator Byer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2765A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2765 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Cruz, would you like to carry this?
Love to.
Good. Okay, we've got one more. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2507. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2507A comes to you from the House Committee on Judiciary. Disqualifies a person arrested for or charged with criminal homicide from determining how the remains of the deceased should be handled, establishes that the decision should be made by the first eligible person listed under ORS 97.130, subsection 2. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we hear testimony on the House side that this is a based on an actual situation, not a decision.
You know, this is one of those things where you say this couldn't not already be law. Okay, nobody signed it.
And nobody wants to come talk about it.
Did somebody in the committee wish to comment on this, since we have nobody signed up on it?
John Brennan must be here for the bill. Maybe he wants to testify.
You mean, so, Madam Chair, so right now somebody could kill somebody and then decide, you know, you kill your spouse and then you decide how they're...
I think they probably decide on cremation most of the time.
I would think.
I guess.
As soon as possible.
Either before or after arrest, I suppose.
Sorry, the evidence that you're saying?
Okay, well, this seems like a worthy bill, so we're going to take a flyer here.
And this came from an actual case?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I remember correctly, it was Representative Wisnett who mentioned that out of Deschutes County there was an actual case where a husband murdered the wife. Then, to dispose of the wife's remains, the first one on the list was the husband, and the husband was less than cooperative. We did amend the bill on the House side to limit it to homicide, and I'm going to go to the actual language.
Mm-hmm.
Criminal homicide is taken out. It was because it's all inclusive.
So he was just content to have his wife just be in the deep freeze forever and a day? Until there was some court order?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Walker, you're 100% right, and I guess it was caused quite a few problems for the family.
Yeah,
as you can well imagine.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
Any other comments? Testimony, Senator Pazansky.
I'm looking at this, and I mean, it's how do we say, a slam dunk? May say a couple other things, but I wonder how this actually plays out. You have someone that dies, and at what point is that, let's say, the spouse or whoever would be in charge of making those arrangements going to be charged with a crime of criminal homicide as to wherein the body may have already been, let's say, taken care of?
As I would read this, in cases where the charge wasn't filed immediately, the person, even if they were later charged, they would still have perfect standing to
dispose
of the
body. Yeah, I mean, would already been done. I mean, unless the... Yeah. District attorney maintains possession of the body and not releasing it to the family for arrangements. I mean, this is the only way that it's going to happen, this sounds like a pretty interesting case where someone has actually premeditatedly killed someone and then, let's say, disposes of the body in a way that it's still not, done away with. I mean, putting it in a deep freeze, you know, and all like that, but it's interesting. I mean, it is. I know what we're trying to do and why we want to do it. I'm just wondering, do we actually accomplish this goal in the majority of these type of cases?
Well, how long a person dies under suspicious circumstances, you know, the coroner's going to hang on to the body until... For how long?
Until the district attorney tells them to release the... Yeah, I mean, they're going to do the autopsy, and they're going to do whatever else they need to do. And as far as I am aware, the district attorney has the ability, as that being part of the evidence or potential evidence of the crime, to maintain control of that.
Right.
Right. They would release the body when they're done with it.
When they're done with it. So, I mean, we would have a resolution, if it's suspicious, of at least who is going to be charged.
Maybe, maybe not.
Okay. Senator Barr.
I mean, there was a case in the last week or 10 days in Milwaukee where a guy ran over his wife and killed her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, in that case, they would know.
That's a slam dunk.
They would know that they would not release the body to him to be disposed of.
Right.
In the case of, yeah, where you don't have anybody, you know, in custody, or you don't know who did the crime, the person's going to be allowed to take care of the body unless it's charged.
Yeah, once it's released. It's just...
Let me ask counsel a question, because that's really a good instance. In that case, counsel, do you have any idea whether the body was released to the guy who ran her over?
I think in the situation that we had, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think it was eventually resolved, but not
I'm
after.
Talking about the one where the guy ran over his wife a couple weeks ago.
This is just like 2 weeks ago.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't know the facts, but just reading the language, a person arrested for or charged with criminal homicide.
I'm asking under current law.
I think under current law it would be problematic from what we heard in the House, that the husband would still be the first person in line to dispose of the person's body. Because when you go over to page 197-130, subsection 2, a person the first listed among the following is a class that is available at the time of death in the absence of actual notice of a contrary direction by the decedent as described in subsection 1 of the section, or actual notice of opposition by completion of a written instrument by a member of the same class or a member of a prior class, may direct any lawful manner disposition of the decedent's remains by completion of a written instrument. Then it gives a list. A first enlist is the spouse of the decedent.
Yeah. No, I think this bill will accomplish a lot of stuff that it intends to do. And clearly, I think in those situations, it would be very hard for, let's say, a family member who's not first in line to realize, as mm-hmm. we've heard, that you know someone could actually cause the body to be cremated, where maybe that wouldn't be what normally would occur. And you would think, you would assume that before the body's released to whoever, that they're going to complete that type of investigation, and there'd be no reason to need to exhume the body if it was buried and such. But, yeah, I think we all should support it, but it's kind of ironic that in this day and time we find ourselves faced with a bill on this topic.
Further discussion? Close public hearing on House Bill 2507. Senator Beyer.
There's a work session, Madam Chair. I'll make the bill.
Oh, details. Open a work session on House Bill 2507.
Today was the day.
2507 with A and Gross to the floor with the due pass recommendations.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2507 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Yes, Senator Beyer.
Former Representative and Senator Harper always said, every bill has a mother. This bill appears not to have a mother.
Okay, with that said, so ordered. Senator Beyer, would you please be this bill's mother? You left yourself wide open, Senator Beyer. Any other business before the committee? We're adjourned.
Well, I was going to say, I'm waiting until they flip the switch off.